never seen as many king salmon in the ocean as I've seen now. And I've been, you know, I've got four generations of trawlers in my family.
Lots of fish, but an uncertain quota for Southeast trawlers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a study documents high rates of erosion on Alaska's north coast, especially east of Barrow.
So there's a lot more going on the Beaufort Coast, and we don't quite know why that is.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Harbors emptied throughout Southeast this week as fishermen head out for the beginning of the summer troll season. July 1st marks the annual start of the summer's first king salmon opener, the most lucrative time of the year for many trawlers. And signs point to a banner year for king salmon. But Southeast fishermen say they're not getting their fair share of those kings. The state of Alaska has been locked in a fight with its neighbors to the south over how many fish the fleet can catch. For now, at least, Alaska seems to have lost, and that has led to calls to change the system. KCAW's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
It's been an uncertain, unsettled spring for many Southeast salmon fishermen. Bert Bergman is a troller in Sitka.
It's been real frustrating because nobody knows what's going to happen. And usually by now, the quota's been announced 2 months ago. Nobody knows how many fish we're catching or why the number is low or how we got this way.
Usually, fishermen have two numbers in hand before the summer season starts, an estimate of how many kings are out there and how many they're allowed to catch. This year, with the season already underway, they don't have either.
And basically, we've had to guess, and dock rumors have ruled the day instead of reason and facts.
That uncertainty came from the Pacific Salmon Commission, which implements the U.S.-Canada Pacific Salmon Treaty. Each year, the commission has to come up with an estimate of king salmon abundance, determine how many kings Alaska fishermen can catch, and decide how many will pass on to Canada, Washington, and Oregon. But this year, the commission deadlocked over those figures, leading to months of wrangling. Days before the summer opening, fishermen weren't sure they'd be fishing at all. Finally, in late June, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced that it would open the summer king salmon fishery. And it would be managed assuming low king salmon abundance. But the state explicitly said it believes that estimate is wrong.
I wouldn't say that we chose this course of action.
That's Charlie Swanton, Alaska's representative on the Salmon Commission. He says Alaska was backed into a corner after representatives from the Pacific Northwest and the federal government threatened to take the state to court. But he says it's not the end of the conversation.
It's hardened my resolve to turn around and find some solutions.
Alaska believes the model used by the commission is deeply flawed. Last year was a huge year for king salmon in Southeast, and this winter's troll fishery was also strong. Meanwhile, forecasts are calling for major returns to the Columbia River Basin. All of that suggests a big year for Chinook, Swanton says. But even though Alaska didn't win any concessions this year, the commission has agreed to revisit its model before next year's fishery. Dale Kelly of the Alaska Trollers Association says that change can't happen soon enough.
We've had 30 years of trying to pay for the sins of the South on habitat destruction. We've cared for fish and repeatedly made sacrifices on behalf of our industry in the region just to rebuild runs that are through the roof.
And now, she says, Alaskans should be benefiting from those rebuilt stocks. She says trawlers don't mind taking fewer fish in years of actual low abundance. But she warns that when the model isn't reliable, it undermines the entire management system. Though the Department of Fish and Game hasn't announced a quota, Kelly fears Alaska fishermen, commercial and sport, will be allowed about 237,000 kings this year, down from nearly 440,000 last year. Troller Bert Bergman says it's clear the process isn't working.
I've never seen as many king salmon in the ocean as I've seen now. And I've been, you know, I've got four generations of trawlers in my family. And, you know, this is to not get part of that fish when we made all the sacrifices to help rebuild the runs, and we helped pay for the hatcheries, and then to not get some of that feels like we've been sold out by the southern states and the department, you know, the National Marine Fisheries Service and NOAA.
But for now, he says he's got no choice. Whatever the quota is, he's fishing it.
I think I'm going to just take a lot of ice and listen to the radio and see what happens.
And fishermen around Southeast are doing the same thing. In Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
Alaska's largest sockeye salmon fishery was predicted to have a near-record return this summer, but so far, the reds have only trickled into Bristol Bay's rivers. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game's preseason estimates suggested 54 million sockeye would return, with 38 million available for harvest. KDLG's Dave Benninger has been tracking the season and says so far, there's a lot of fishermen scratching their heads.
So right now everybody's wondering, is this going to come in smaller than predicted, the same size, et cetera? But they are just kind of trickling in right now, and that's been very frustrating, I think, for fishermen all up and down the bay, whether they're set netting or drifting, that they had really thought they would be catching some of this big run earlier in the season before the processing capacity becomes could become an issue, I suppose. And the folks that we've talked to daily are just not seeing the catches that they thought they would see by this point.
Dave, what's the theory? Why do managers think it's so slow?
You know, we ask that question every day. that's the million-dollar or multi-million-dollar question. And the sense that I get is that they don't have a good working theory yet, and part of that is because the test fishery that operates at Port Mueller needs to see the catch and escapement data from the inshore districts, meaning they need to see what the harvest turns into and the sockeye that make it up the rivers are counted as, so that they can compare their data and decide what their test fishery catches equal the inshore run. They don't have that yet because there just hasn't been enough catch and escapement inshore. So they think they saw a peak of test fishery catches on the 29th, and it's slowly tapering back off from there. So in their last interpretation, they said if that was the peak, there's a good chance this run is not as big as we thought it might be. Number two, if it is as big as we thought it might be, there's a good chance it's coming in very late. And I think by the weekend, we'll have a lot better idea of whether or not this run is what it was predicted to be and its timing. And I would just say that I think every fisherman in Bristol Bay has their nets and boats ready for what may be a really big push of fish. At least they're hoping that it that the rest of this run shows up, and it may show up all at once.
So, Dave, describe the scene for us. Where are fishermen, and what are they doing to wait it out?
Well, the KDLG team has kind of been up and down the bay a bit this year, which has been good. And in the Igigik District, people have been fishing pretty steady for a while now. In Nushigat District, closest to where we're at, the fishing effort has been pretty steady. In Naknek-Quijack, which has the most registered boats and permits right now, it's expecting 28 million fish with 18 million available for harvest. They're not doing a whole lot, and we do hear from them quite a bit that they are frustrated, and we were over there for some of their openers, and I wouldn't say that they're pessimistic, but they have been sitting on their hands for too long for anybody to feel good about what's going on right now, and they're getting real anxious about getting some opportunity to fish. Around here, the set netters that are fishing in Nushigak and so forth, it's been very low catches, but steady work. So they're keeping after it. And I talked to one drifter who was down on the south line of Nushigak last evening, and he said, you know, we're catching 2,000, 3,000, maybe 4,000 pounds a day right now for the last 4 or 5 days. He said, that's not bad. We're getting regular work and regular sleep, and hey, it's fishing. So there's that attitude as well.
Dave Benninger is news director at KDLG in Dillingham. Yesterday, Ethan Berkowitz formally became the new mayor of Anchorage. As KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, the celebration downtown was a marked departure from past inaugurations, with a heavy emphasis on changing directions at City Hall.
Around, there's a whole lot of pretty ladies, and like you, you shine so bright. Yeah. Berkowitz's swearing in was an informal affair. Frankly, it felt more like a block party than a government event. Supporters, local politicians, curious passersby, Town Square Park was filled with hundreds of people, while the Vinyl Floors, a band from West High School, played on stage.
Hey, Rick, we still have virtually no guitar up here.
Can we get a little more guitar in the monitors?
The ceremony itself was short and sweet. It was also diverse, something speakers as well as audience members noted. The event opened with a Dena'ina prayer and eventually yielded to a Yupik dance group and hip-hop performance. Rhetoric throughout drew on language from community activism, emphasizing Anchorage's multiculturalism, as well as subtle nods towards progressive values. It's the same tone Berkowitz used on the campaign trail and throughout his transition into office the last 2 months.
We are, in many ways, liberated from the way things have been done before, and we have the responsibility and the ability to take care of ourselves. It's our time to make a new Anchorage.
The mayor's office in Anchorage is technically nonpartisan, and while there were no overt jabs at the conservative, outgoing Sullivan administration, there was a decidedly liberal flavor to the festivities, with downtown Democratic legislators smiling beside prominent community activists. For attendee David Landry in the audience, the openness of the event set a tone unlike past inaugurations.
Just very excited to have a new kind of a new generation of mayor and town, and it's about time.
As for specifics in Berkowitz's policy agenda, details are scant, but the focus remains on issues highlighted in the campaign.
Working on public safety issues, we've been working on economic development issues. We're also getting the early stages of preparing the next budget. So we've been hard at work even before we moved into the office.
But the remainder of the afternoon was for celebration, music, and a very long line for free cupcakes. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a regatta on Ketchumak Bay with almost no wind.
We were very close to the buoy at one time. We are supposed to go to our next marker, and we are not.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
As July begins and the National Weather Service resets their annual snowfall totals to zero, it's official. Anchorage's snowfall levels last winter are the lowest on record. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Anchorage's official total for the 2014-2015 snowfall season is 25.1 inches. National Weather Service meteorologist Dave Snyder says that beat the previous record set in 1957-58 by more than 5 inches.
Something else to keep in mind is this new record's about one-third of the normal seasonal snowfall, which is about 74.5 inches or so. We count that over about 30 years and take the average.
Snyder says only 3 of the last 12 months exceeded the normal monthly precipitation averages. And he says the effects of such a low snow winter are evident in this year's busy fire season.
The snow here in Anchorage is just a point representation, but many other locations like the Susitna Valley, like the western Kenai Peninsula, all those regions were very low on snow this year, and that affects the moisture level of the ground, of the shrubs and the landscape, and all that is feeding into the dramatic fire season we're seeing this year.
Wildfires have burned more than 2.2 million acres so far this summer. This year's record low comes just 3 years after Anchorage saw a record high annual snowfall of 134.5 inches in the 2011-2012 season. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
A new study from the U.S. Geological Survey finds that Alaska's northern coast has some of the highest rates of erosion in the world. One bluff 70 miles east of Barrow is eroding more than 60 feet per year. The report is part of an effort to assess shoreline change across the United States. The study looked at almost 1,000 miles of Alaska shoreline from Icy Cape east to the Canadian border. Ann Gibbs is a geologist and lead author of the report. She says most of the coast is eroding at about a meter a year.
And that might not sound like a lot, but compared to the rest of the United States, except for the Gulf Coast states of Louisiana and Mississippi, all the other shorelines are closer to a rate of maybe a half a meter a year or less.
Was it a lot harder to do this work in Alaska as opposed to some of the other coastal areas you're studying?
The reason it was harder in Alaska is that the data sets just didn't exist. So for the lower 48, there's been a lot of work and effort done to bring the old maps into digital format and have them be georeferenced and have them be accurate. In Alaska, people hadn't taken a look at this information and tried to bring it into a digital world so that you could do the same type of analysis. So we spent a lot of time doing that and doing the quality control and double-checking. And the other kind of unique thing about the North Slope is that there isn't a lot of infrastructure. So you can't look at a road and see if that road moves over time, or a building, corner of a building, where if you're looking at images in the lower 48, you can see if your images are co-registered correctly. In Alaska, that's a little harder to do because there aren't the features on the ground that you're confident haven't changed position over time.
How about the differences that are between the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea coast? What are you seeing there?
That's interesting. So for the whole, it's about 1,000 miles of coastline that we evaluated. And for that whole area, it's about an average of a meter, 1.4 meters a year average erosion rate. On the Chukchi side, the average rate is about 0.3 meters a year. And on the Beaufort coast, it's about six times higher, 1.7 meters a year. So there's a lot more going on the Beaufort coast. And we don't quite know why that is. It has to do with a combination of the geology, the rock strength, the direction of waves, and the energy of waves that are hitting that part of the coast.
And what are the implications of this erosion?
In contrast to like the lower 48, where most of the coast is really heavily populated on the Arctic coast of Alaska, you know, it's really pretty uninhabited. But there are a lot of federally owned lands up there. There's a lot of oil and gas infrastructure that could be threatened by coastal erosion. There's a number of older defense early warning stations that are scattered across the slope that are located right on the coast. And most of them have been shut down, but the infrastructure remains there and they need to be cleaned up. And then there's also the habitat issues. You know, there's major nesting grounds and flyways for a lot of the birds and habitat for fish. And so as the coastal landscape changes, those habitats potentially change as well and affect where the animals can nest and grow and feed.
This particular study from USGS doesn't look at what might be causing the erosion, but you've started studying that issue. What have you found so far?
We're just in the initial stages of that, but a lot of work that's been done points to the amount of ice that's in the bluffs. So this is in a zone of continuous permafrost. So the ground's frozen down several hundred meters under the ground. But as the air temperature and water temperatures increase, that the ice that's holding together the soils, the permafrost soils, starts to thaw and weakens the surface and the compaction of the sediments. So I think that's one of the issues. We don't really understand how that ice content varies across the North Slope. So that's a big question we're trying to answer.
Ann Gibbs is a USGS geologist and lead author of this report.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
As salmon swim up the Yukon River, subsistence fishermen continue to express frustration about gear restrictions, closures, and now potentially infected fish. When managers and fishermen met for their weekly teleconference this week, they heard reports of discoloration and pus in chum salmon from callers in Pilot Station, Russian Mission, and Fairbanks. Stephanie Schmidt, summer season area management biologist for the Yukon and for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, says the parasite Ichthyophonus could be the culprit. Fish and Game says the pathogen is not harmful to humans. The summer chum run is now estimated at about 1.5 million fish, which is average, but below Fish and Game's preseason predictions. The first pulses are passing through Tanana, Koyukuk, and Kaltag, but many stragglers are still lingering in the lower river. Schmidt says that's led to record numbers for commercial fishermen.
There have been record catches of summer chum salmon with dipness this year in District 1 and District 2. To date, the dipnet and beach seine commercial fishery in these lower river districts have caught 185,700 summer chum salmon, and they've released just over 8,000 Chinook salmon.
Meanwhile, subsistence fishing has been a mixed bag. Abundant chums on the lower Yukon have helped fishermen like Joseph in Nunum Iqua to fill his racks.
They had a 3-hour subsistence opening on Tuesday. We were finally able to fish the tide, and I was able to get 118 chums and 6 kings, and I was so happy for the kings.
But fishermen upriver have struggled to meet their subsistence needs, citing plenty of activity but little production. Bristol Bay Elder Yelmer Ofi Olson passed away at an Anchorage hospital late Wednesday, according to family friends. Olson, who had been battling kidney failure for weeks, was 75. Olson was a veteran Bristol Bay fisherman, served in the U.S. Army, and was the longtime president, CEO, and chairman of the board of the Bristol Bay Native Corporation. Bryce Edgman of Dillingham spent Saturday evening with Olson, visiting the boat harbor and subsistence fishing sites at Kinnekinnek Beach.
Well, I think we all knew that that he wasn't in the best of health, and more recently that his health was, in fact, deteriorating. And I just learned very early this morning that he had, in fact, passed. And, you know, a big shock to everyone, even though, again, we all knew that his health was in the decline. But just really sorry to see him go.
Olson's health problems had kept him mostly in his home in recent months and required several hospitalizations in Anchorage. Information on funeral arrangements was not available yet, though a family friend did say postponing a service until after the Bristol Bay commercial fishing season was over was being considered. The 19th annual Land's End Regatta ended the way a sailboat race shouldn't. It was called on the second day for lack of wind. For 2 days, boats and crews tried to make the best of the extremely calm weather. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver boarded a boat for the story.
Fair winds and following seas, a blessing for sailors heading out onto the water at the mercy of time and tides. It was what we hoped for the Arctica, a small but mighty sailboat with its motley crew of recent surgery patients, pregnant women, and greenhorns. First up, de facto first mate, Liska Kandror.
It gets exciting for sure, you know, you have to move fast and things drop out of your hands and then there's a gust of wind that comes up and it's a good time.
Her friend, Allison Shockley.
So she invited me and I thought, well, I'm not going to miss up a cool opportunity to really experience Alaska.
And mild-mannered yet fearless Captain Craig Forrest.
I've been sailing in Homer now since 1977.
My partner John and I, along with Allie, could all say we'd been near sailboats before, but not necessarily on them, and certainly not crewed them. So on the first day, we learned to sail.
Sail's gonna go to that side. So let's sail out.
It started slow, with the first several hours calm, calm, calm.
When there's almost no wind, everything that we do on the boat makes a difference. So if you step a little too hard in one direction, that makes the boat do something that we might not like. A boat goes by us and puts up a wake that shakes the wind out of the sails, so we can't maneuver. It's just really, really difficult.
It picked up toward afternoon, and for the last hour, we splashed through the waves, tacking and jibing, racing around the marker buoys. We went home that night tired and sore.
Oh, man. Crawling around on deck gave me some black and blueies on my knees, I'll tell you what.
But we came back the next day, ready to hit the water again. We were confident. We hopped up on deck, got her ready to go. Ready for squall and gale were we. But instead, nothing. The occasional whisper of half a breeze flopped the sails around the wrong way.
Well, we were very close to the buoy at one time. We are supposed to go to our next marker, and we are not. We are slowly drifting in circles.
And so we spun and spun, and the buoy got smaller and smaller. And then we got caught by the current, which was moving faster than the wind.
If for some reason we can't turn, we're doing 1.5 knots backwards.
And so we sat, sometimes drifting in the wrong direction, sometimes twirling like a top, but mostly we just sat, bobbing like a cork in Kachemak Bay. So we turned to sea shanties.
We're sailors who sail nowhere. Hurrah, hurrah. We're sailors who sail nowhere.
At the end of the day, the race was called. Not enough wind to complete the course. So we took advantage of modern technology and got towed back to the harbor. Disappointing? Not at all. We came as strangers to the Arctica and left as friends, with a greater appreciation for the sea and the art of sailing, and we revised our hopes for next time. Fair winds and following seas, but if not, good company, please. On Kachemak Bay, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Come all you young sailormen, listen to me. I'll sing you a song of the fish in the sea. And it's windy weather, boys, stormy weather, boys.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholz in Sitka, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Zachariah Hughes and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Laura Cagle in Nome, and Shady Grove Oliver on Kachemak Bay. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Baby salmon live here, right in our backyards and neighborhoods. Go out, explore, and take the Baby Salmon Challenge. For more information, go to babysalmon.fish. This announcement is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.